This week on a special episode of Decentralize, an interview with legendary producer and musician Steve Albini.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
So Tony, you had a really interesting experience with a guest recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I am actually, I would say probably the most famous and well-known person we've had on the show, although Kane definitely rivals him, is Steve Albini, and he's one of the most unique and interesting voices in music. He's got an attitude that's very much different from most that are in the music industry, and some of the things he spoke about were absolutely fascinating. And I took a shot and I emailed him. I said, hey, you want to come on our podcast? And, you know, He originally kind of declined, and he wasn't very keen on Bitcoin, but I convinced him in a second email, he agreed, and we talked for an hour, and we had a very interesting discussion. And just as a little background of what Steve has really done, as his most known work would be producing the last Nirvana record, In Utero, but he's very influential in the production game. The Pixies, Slint, Iggy and the Stooges, Fugazi, Cheap Trick. These are the big bands he's done, not to mention the tons of indie projects. And he actually has his own studio called Electrical Audio. And what's unique about Steve Albini is his business practices. He does not take royalty points. He refuses to. Anyone can book him by the hour. Whatever band you're in, you can book him by the hour. And considering how notable he is, that's really strange, you know? And especially in the era where he was producing records for like Bush and other, you know, kind of post-grunge bands, you know, that labels didn't necessarily want to work with him because of his attitude, which has been very anti-mainstream major record label. And he's also got really unique views on the internet, and that being, he's a fan of streaming. He's a fan of free music. He thinks music should be free. And I don't want to go into a ton of his details of what he's talking about, but I do want people to know that his voice really matters. And when he says something, when he writes a piece in The Guardian, the music industry takes note. And a week ago, he said something informative about Tidal, and it was very negative on it, which I've been very negative on the whole Tidal streaming service since it came out. And, you know, obviously it's getting bad press today or tomorrow, but it just seemed like it wasn't going to work. And it was interesting to see Steve's take and to see Steve's take on Bitcoin, which was not positive. And, there's tons of other things this guy has done. And that's what's interesting about him is, you know, he's in Chicago. He lives a very modest life. His business practices are amazing. And he hangs out with some really intelligent people. I found out he's friends with Nate Silver. He's, he hangs out with people you would not suspect. And his forum's excellent. He recommends it. And, you know, do you guys have any questions? Because what I want to do is I want to get the decentralized audience involved on this. And I know they're going to have questions. And they're going to wonder, who is Steve Albini? What does he do? Why is he important? Why is he on this podcast? And since you two are not as familiar with him as I am, but, you know, you can ask me things about his career because I've been a fan of his bands for like 10, 15 years, and his production methods. So please, by all means, ask anything on me, and I would be more than happy to go into it from the music perspective.
Well, I think our listeners know a little bit about what to expect from the podcast just from your description here, but I'm interested in sort of what prompted you to reach out to him originally. Obviously, you have quite a background in the music industry, but what was it about that connected in your mind, Steve, to what we're doing here?
It was actually an amazing piece in The Guardian that I missed because he's also a journalist. He has a journalism degree, and he writes for The Guardian mostly about music issues and intellectual property. And when I'm reading some of the article, I don't know if this is where the quote was from, but he says, I have a lifelong war with the idea of intellectual property. And I was like, that's interesting. Not what you would expect from a music guy. And really, the entire point of the article was saying, this is why it's better now for musicians than ever. It's eliminated middlemen. You know, and one of his most famous pieces came out around 93, and it was about signing with a major label and how many artists sign with a major label and end up in debt after their first record, even if it does rather well, because the label really existed as a way to churn money and not really do anything productive, like a bureaucracy, like a government. And he basically would just, you know, he went into that detail about why it's better, because if you release your own records, you don't sell 10 million. You might sell 100,000, but you get half the profits of everything and you own the masters. So you can re-release them in any way you want. And, you know, it's fascinating to see like his business perspective, how he views streaming, how he's so just pro, you know, the internet really. And it's strange because he's also notorious for being one of the producers that refuses to use digital equipment in his production methods, which I completely agree with, because technically analog equipment is better, hands down, for music recording. And that could shift from digital fans, but digital's convenient though. And he illustrated a great point in both the piece and in the podcast that the next thing that comes out is not going to be, you know, Tidal. It's not going to be another streaming service. That's not going to disrupt anything. It's going to be a more convenient platform. And what his idea is great. And it's interesting because he's very, he's the most arrogant, humble guy you've ever met. And it's fascinating. But he backs up everything he says, and he's kind of known as a curmudgeon in the online community, though, which I don't get. He's just very realistic.
That's very interesting. I didn't realize he was such an idealist. Are his views considered like extremely unique in the record industry?
Yes, absolutely. Especially from like the era of the mid '90s. But also it's because of how he grew up, and it was really more of a hand to mouth thing where he grew up in that punk scene where, you know, they own the rights to their records, you know, and they own the rights to everything, and they sold it. And he talks a little bit about, you know, the way that distribution happened before the internet, fanzines and different ways to find out about albums and shows and just how that all worked without a major label backing it. It was really quite awesome, and how the internet's only made that easier, and how little artists see from, you know, their album sales. And it's just fascinating. And he's very, very, very not into Bitcoin. But he's also someone I think that doesn't have a mind for the finance end. It just is not something he's interested in. And it's interesting. Our Bitcoin conversation is interesting. And it really, you know, he made me struggle to think of some ideas that, you know, okay, so what uses of Bitcoin aren't for financial reasons? And there are some, and I came up with some, but some, almost everything I could come up with related to finance. And it made me realize that, you know, this needs to appeal to way more people if we're going to cause the change that we want to change. It's going to need to appeal to people that are in art, that are, you know, in media, that are in, you know, journalism, rather than the tech folk, the tech fans, you know, and the people that are already involved. And it was really fascinating on that end. So,
yeah, well, it sounds like he's almost into decentralization at kind of a deeper level, at a more kind of localized level. And one thing we definitely recognize on this podcast is that maybe Bitcoin isn't for everyone. And maybe this conversation is sort of interesting, kind of light into that. But that's a good point, Tony. These kind of conversations bring us into contact with people who don't know our kind of our circles and our jargon, and they aren't kind of a part of our culture. So it's going to be quite interesting, I think, for our listeners to hear someone who's not only done some really cool things, like produced the Nirvana records. I mean, like, I'm absolutely surprised all the time by the kind of people we get on this show and by what they've done. So I think it's always fun to add these perspectives.
Yeah, and having him on the show, you know, because there's one more thing I wanted to talk about that we talked about in the interview, and then our goal. And I'll mention the goal first because it's really succinct, is I want someone to listen to the show and think of, hey, he's got an idea. This can still be disrupted and made better for artists where they have more control over the art they make. And that's what I'm really hoping is the result of this. But as a follow-up, one of the most interesting things he said about was talking about online communities, and just recommended a few, which was the two, I think it was the 2&2 or 2+2 forums, which is a poker community, and his own message board. And I cannot encourage everyone enough to go to his website, which is electricalaudio.com, and check out his forum. It's huge. I couldn't believe how many people post there. And the conversations are very different from everything that you would ever expect on a forum like that. Very interesting, different people. And that's very cool. So, you know, I really hope everyone enjoys it. I was flattered to have an hour and speak with him. I'd also encourage everyone to check out his band, Shellac. They're awesome. They're like a mix of like jazz and funk and metal, and very technical and awesome. Very cool and punk. So we just wanted to say, you know, enjoy the interview with Steve Albini and check out his work.
We're here with Steve Albini, and we have some awesome things to discuss and had a great conversation via email yesterday, and a bunch of things I wanted to ask him about via, you know, about decentralization and the music industry and a lot of other different topics. So how are you doing today, Steve?
I'm doing terrific.
Awesome. Well, I think a really good place to start would be something that you said recently about the new service Tidal, and really what you thought the end game was for streaming music on the internet. And it really was something drastically different from the models that are being presented right now. Can you go into a little more detail about that?
Well, I mean, what's happening now is the people who are whose conception of the music industry is based on the royalty model are trying to find a way to make the royalty model survive into an era where the music is disassociated from physical goods, okay? Royalties are appropriate when you can inventory something and you can do an audit and a physical count and find out how many of something there are, and then you can be paid per unit of however many of them there are, either however many of them there are in existence or however many of them were sold of an inventory, right? So that's the model that the that physical record sales royalties worked on. And the all of the streaming concepts now are trying to find a way to make a per-play or per-listen royalty viable in an instant in an era where there is no physical object that can be inventoried, and there's essentially no way to audit or accurately discern how many times something has been listened to. Because that is a problem, a lot of they're trying to find other means of sharing, of generating money and apportioning money, stakeholding in a service is one way of doing that. So if you're a shareholder in a streaming service, and that streaming service delivers music to listeners, and that streaming service turns a profit, well, then you make money, right? If you're a musician and your music is played by a streaming service, you're unlikely to make money. The streaming service can attempt to attach a monetary value to each instance of playing your music, but even that is dicey because of the nature of data transfer, it's really difficult to tell when something has actually been listened to. It's also impossible to tell if it's listened to multiple times, if it's been captured on the other end, or if it's been released into the wild and now available, you know, in a bunch of other venues. So my take on this whole concept of streaming is that it's just a stopgap measure toward something that is eventually going to be much more diffuse and much less controllable. The streaming services are trying to lock up artists in the same way that record labels used to. Like, you get an artist under an exclusive contract to your record label, and then no matter how bad the terms of your deal with that artist are, they can't go elsewhere to make their records. If you get an artist locked up into your streaming service, then their music is going to be available exclusively through your streaming service, at least until it breaks out into the wild. And so then that makes your streaming service attractive to fans of that artist, right? But the nature of the internet is such that you can't keep things in little pens like that. Like, you can't have private content that's available publicly, because eventually it all just gets out. And so these streaming services, I think, are doomed because the exclusivity, which gives them their individual cachet, is the one thing that they cannot maintain. Now, Tidal is trying to, like, bridge the gap between hi-fi listening at home, where people listen to records on hi-fi systems, and convenience listening, where people listen in their on their iPhones or on their cars or their laptops, using streaming services or you know, downloads or something of that nature, by offering higher quality downloads. But I mean, higher quality downloads have been available for a very long time, and they haven't really jumped out as a market leader because the extra bandwidth required for the higher resolution and the extra memory storage required on the user's end, and in some cases hardware upgrades were required to play them, just don't warrant the attention that the, you know, like, it's not a selling point. You know, if it makes your life harder, it costs you more money, and it takes up more space on your computer, well, then it needs to be like a drastic improvement in order for that to be worth it. And in a lot of places, you know, internet connectivity is not fantastic, and so trying to get super high bandwidth data to come down a wire and play his music is not really going to be effective. So whereas, you know, if you can take a lot longer to download something and get it in full resolution from a torrent or something, well, then people are just going to do that, you know.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things you mentioned was the small app that would exist basically to find and, you know, basically scour various parts of the internet, be it BitTorrent networks, be it, you know, traditional networks, like maybe even YouTube, things like that, where you would be able to pick up that song.
I mean, if you think about it, like the internet is vast, and there's a whole bunch of little nuggets of joy scattered throughout it, right? You know, there's probably some Netscape, what was that Earthlink, or what was that really early web page hosting site? Was like
GeoCities, Angel Fire. I'm thinking of those.
Call it Angel. Let's say Angel Fire. Like, there's probably some like awesome thing posted somewhere in one of those ancient spots that's not linked to anywhere else. That's not and it's gonna, you know, you wouldn't find it on your own. But if there was an autonomous like crawler that knew your tastes and would look for things and could evaluate them as to whether or not you liked them and find them from all over, well, then it wouldn't matter if things were centralized into one streaming service or another, or if you were in one, you know, master library, or if you were, if Pandora recognized that musical identity as part of its genome project or whatever. Like, you get, if computers get smart enough, and they are, and they're getting there, that they can discern what kind of music something is by listening to it, then a computer could, like, directed by you, find things from everywhere on the internet. An app could find things from everywhere on the internet, and then you could hear them whenever you wanted them. You wouldn't need to be a member of a service. You wouldn't need to have, you wouldn't need to give up any information about yourself. You wouldn't need to physically possess anything. This app would just find it for you and play it for you. And that seems like a perfectly, that seems like a reasonable development from where we are now, and that would obviously be more convenient than having to become a member of a service and pay a fee and all that kind of stuff. So the convenience aspect of streaming is nice for the moment, but there has always been a convenience format for music that competed with the sort of hi-fi format. And the convenience formats don't last very long, because sooner or later something else comes along that's more convenient than the 8-track cartridge, for example. And then you have the CD, and it's much more convenient. And then sooner or later something comes along that's more convenient than that, like the cassette, or the cassette came before the CD, but then the, downloads are, a huge library was available, at the click of a button. So that's much more convenient than a CD, and then streaming is more convenient than that because you don't have to go through the effort of downloading something. So is it possible that something could be more convenient than streaming? Well, of course, obviously. And so I don't see streaming as being the end game of the convenience war,
Yeah, it seems more like the best solution we have now, like a lot of things in technology in general, it's the best thing we have now. But what I think really is interesting about what you said, and one of the problems that I see, which I think I'm a big fan of identifying the problems because those are things people can work on, is the closed ecosystems of things like Apple, really, where, if you want to use BitTorrent, you really are limited to any kind of BitTorrent software. You're really limited, in having a jailbroken iPhone. I mean, obviously it would work on Android, but that immediately locks whatever service you're offering out to many people. So I think that the end game is really something similar.
What you're saying is that Apple doesn't want that business. Apple doesn't want those people as customers.
Right.
And that's fine. Those people are obviously, if that becomes a desire for people, then somebody will create an add-on of some kind, or there will be a black market app like you described that will make that viable. Or, I mean, just because of one or the other industry players doesn't want to play along doesn't mean that the morphology, the evolution of the internet is going to stop.
I think also it does involve the design as well, whereas if it was designed so it did not, it didn't need Apple's approval, it didn't need something like that to access the BitTorrent network or to access any kind of decentralized network. And I have more to talk with you about that in a minute. But I think that really is the answer. I don't know if it's web-based. I don't know if it's something that's just, you know, a different model from what we're doing now. But I do think your idea has a lot of merit. And when I spoke with you, I really felt that you understood the music industry more than most in general. And, you know, and your attitude is drastically different from many in the industry. And it has been for a long time, to be fair. And you did say something also to me that you had I don't want to use the quote, but I'll paraphrase, something like a lifelong problem with royalties. So this is not something
That I have a problem with royalties. I think that they have an application, but that application is sort of limited to the physical distribution model. I've had a lifelong war with the concept of intellectual property.
Okay, I
think the concept of intellectual property is extraordinarily misapplied. It's much, much more cumbersome and problematic than it is useful in terms of solving a problem. Just the ubiquity of the patent troll lawsuits, the ways that everyone in their normal life is expected to accommodate and the desires of rights holders in every aspect of their lives. I just find it enormously encumbering, and I think the concept of intellectual property is so wrong at its base that something else needs to be codified into law, because using intellectual property as the basis for everything just limits the behavior of normal people into these odd prescribed things that serves only the corporate interest. It doesn't serve doesn't benefit any individual like creator or any individual creative person.
Yeah, and I think that what you're saying there is a reason why a lot of what the technology that's coming out, a lot of the stuff that we talk about in the show, it's really just starting to really gain an audience. And, you know, we're trying to really spread the word about, you know, the open source ideology along with, you know, and I mentioned this to you, and I want to get into this a little bit, Bitcoin, because I think that is going to end up being super important, not as a currency, but as a protocol and as the way things work in
so
the future.
Your listeners obviously know all of this because they're listening to
yes.
you, but I'm not part of this culture. I'm not part of the computer geek underground. So explain to me why Bitcoin is not money.
Well, it is money, but the thing is, it's not just money, right? It's actually, it's like any other protocol. It's a way to transfer information, and it really comes down to it. Money is just another format of transferring information, and it really has a lot of similarities.
Well, I disagree. Money is a transfer tool for value.
Yes, represented by a physical token that transfers information.
Say that again?
Represented by a physical token that transfers information along with value.
The information is sort of trivial. You mean the serial number of the dollar bill? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, no, more what it represents. I would say ignore, you know what, let me go back a minute and say ignore, you know, the physical idea of a dollar. And think about when you buy something with your debit card or your credit card. You know, you really don't see anything there, but you do have that perceived value. And it's all about that perceived value, right? The first application for the Bitcoin technology happened to be a currency. There's going to be many more. And there already are many more. And it's moving to that next step. It's moving from the bulletin board era into the World Wide Web era, where, you know, hyperlinks are coming out. And I mean that in a way, it's just an analogy way, where, you know, there really are things being built on it that are changing things much beyond currency. And I think, you know...
Give me an example.
Okay. Smart contracts. They're autonomous contracts that exist on the blockchain that are basically... that exist outside of... having a third party, okay? So you don't need an attorney to create a smart contract. It would be a self-directed contract on the blockchain that would basically run itself. Collect the money when in a cryptocurrency format, of course, not in a traditional, you know,
so
dollar,
money.
US dollar, yeah. It would collect it, and then maybe, let's say you were to purchase something, or you were to say, I will send you $500 on this date. It will automatically write to the blockchain that a permanent record, the blockchain is a permanent record that is shared and distributed across many computers, that this is something and this is who owns the property of this. Now, we're such in the infancy of this that it's still, you know, an idea.
So ultimately it's about ownership and obligation and money.
Yes.
We're still talking about finance.
We are, and that in some degree, and I think maybe that's where I should have moved on to a different kind of statement. We're also talking about the project that I'm working on is Augur, and it's built on something called Ethereum, which is really getting a label of Bitcoin 2.0, and I'm just saying that to simplify. A couple other people that are working on it, IBM are working on it and utilizing it basically to control the Internet of Things, and that's a very basic explanation of that, but it really doesn't have a direct use with currency, but it may have an aspect of it where a currency could be utilized in a way that's really a protocol that's very similar to what Ethereum is, and enables people to buy things with it, and you know, without the need of a third party, right? So there's no need when you're, let's say, if you were to sell a song, and it was, you know, you wanted a dollar, and you know, you just put it on the, you just put it out there. Again, we're years away from this. And you wanted to sell it, you wouldn't need to deal with an iTunes. You wouldn't need to deal with a Spotify.
I already don't need to.
You're right, you don't. But you also still need someplace to host it, which means that you're going to, you could use SoundCloud, sure. You also, that means you also usually have to sign up for and agree to terms of service, which is a legal contract. And there's a lot of...
Or I could just have it on the server in my apartment. Right. I don't understand why you're...
Well, try to monetize that. If you wanted, let's say you wanted to sell it. And let's just pretend that's what your goal is. You want a dollar a track, right? And you wanted to monetize it. Whatever choice you have, you are going to pay fees to a third party. Now, they might not be much, they may be negligible, but those add up. And those fees, that 2 to 10%.
I mean, if you plug something into the wall, you're paying the electric company for the electricity that required to run the thing that you're putting your Ethereum on.
Right.
So you're there are always going to be operating expenses, and I don't understand why you're why the smallest least inconveniencing part of it would be the deal breaker.
And I don't think that's a deal breaker at all.
Okay.
And I what I think it is it's an improvement of who controls the ecosystem that's distributing this content. And really, that's what it's about.
Well, my point of all of this is that these attempts to control are doomed because the internet itself is a mechanism to thwart control.
Absolutely.
So the fact that somebody seems to think he has an exclusive hold on who can listen to his music is a fantasy.
Right. And go ahead, sorry.
What you're describing is another tool for someone maintaining that fantasy.
See, I don't necessarily I don't have a great response for that, and that's my fault for not being more prepared to answer that question, because I don't necessarily think that the infrastructure is there. And I think that's one of the reasons I really wanted you on, because I liked your idea, and I think that it's something that developers need to hear. They need to hear, you know, what musicians and artists want to control their destiny, to control their art. Right. And create a more fair system. And it is, as far as it being a fantasy, I think that it's going to be much closer to a reality where,
well,
you know, really,
okay, for a start, I think you need to recalibrate one thing. The people in the music scene, the people in the day to day working musician scene are not enormously dissatisfied. The people who are dissatisfied are the corporate interests who previously had a stranglehold on distribution music. Working musicians are actually quite enjoying things as they are. And the idea that we need to break the paradigm and create a more fair system is kind of fallacious, because the people who are complaining about the way things are developing on their own organically are the billionaire players from the old collapsed model of physical distribution. Those people have lost their angle. They can no longer siphon money out of a relationship between a band and its audience. The band and the audience now can get along fine. If a band, you know, if you want a download, a track, a CD, a T-shirt, a concert ticket, a poster, an 8x10 glossy, you can get that directly from the band. You don't need any intermediary anymore. There doesn't need to be any infrastructure whatsoever. Certainly, things like iTunes and SoundCloud and YouTube and all of those things are avenues for exposure, and people can interact with music in those, through those things. But not every scrap of that needs to be or should be or even is desirably monetized. the direct relationship that a band has with its audience is always going to provide some avenue of support. At the moment, these like the sort of interactions between a band and its audience, the primary venue is live music, which seems to have, which has worked for, you know, tens of thousands of years. It's a you know, somebody goes someplace and he does something and he gets fed dinner, you know, or someone does a performance and he gets paid, and that seems to work really well as a means of compensating people who want to do performing art. The people who are not satisfied with that are the people who don't want to perform very much, and the people who just want to make a record now and again and have the rest of the world pay them a tribute for having done it. And that, you know, that as a business model, like making horseshoes, is kind of outmoded.
Yes, I do agree with that, and I absolutely agree with that. I think that maybe focusing too exclusively on music distribution here is muddying the case that I'm trying to make, which I will fault myself for.
I understand that there are other things than music, but I don't know anything about those other things. I can only speak with authority about the way musicians behave and the way the musicians interact with their audience.
Yes.
So, you know, I've been around it my whole life. I see it every day, and I kind of know how that's working. But everything else, I have to take your word for it that these kinds of Bitcoin things are different from what I think they are.
Yes, and
but I still don't get how it's not money.
Well, it is money, and that's the weird thing, and that's another part that is creating problems to explain it and to explain this to people, is because it's more than that, and it's just money is the first app that really gained popularity, and I think the thing I want to do is like take it back a couple years and make a really good analogy that I enjoy making, and you know, the modern financial industries are really, really no different than the music industry that I remember, and you know, that I remember before the internet, right? Because I remember getting the internet when I was about 12 or 13, and it really changed how I viewed things. Mm-hmm. And back then, you know, you're very familiar with it. You know, you had a very famous piece that was released that explained how the music industry worked. It took advantage of artists, and it took advantage of fans, all for the benefit of the people in the middle. And
sure.
that's a very astute point you made, and it was very clear. And label spending was ridiculous. They basically spent tons of money so employees would remain employed. And eventually, software came out that really made it easier for fans to have an alternative way to get it. And, you know, the music industry immediately scoffed, didn't understand it because it was threatening their model, and they just didn't get it. They lived in that world of, you know, selling pre-recorded music for so long that this just was foreign to them. And then they tried to fight it. And what they didn't realize is at the entire time what was happening was where people were mad. They were gouged for years. Users, fans, consumers, they were pissed, right? They were like, okay, I'm tired of wasting all this money on things that I don't feel I'm getting a value out of. So I'm going to download the song for free. I may not necessarily think that, you know, it's worth nothing, but what I do know is that it's not worth $20. So what ended up happening was Napster got shut down because of legal reasons, which, fine, it wasn't the end game, obviously. So it's software, it always evolves. And the next step was BitTorrent. It increased decentralization, and it increased the efficiency of a way to transfer files for everyone. And it made it more affordable for artists and more affordable for fans, really. And it had a lot of advantages. Of course, the music industry fought. Eventually, iTunes came out. They conceded on that point. And what ended up happening, and they didn't even notice or weren't noticing, was that the actual economic value in the real world, not the conceived world where the pretend world they live in, but the real world of a song was very, very little or nothing. And that outraged them. And that is because it really goes against what they believed in for a long time. And give me another minute, because I want to illustrate another point here. And that's how we ended up here and now with the music industry, how it is, and how now any artist can really distribute to whoever they want and really just deal with directly to the fans. It's, as you've said, it's improved for everyone in the music industry except the music industry or the record industry, not necessarily the music industry, because musicians are much better off and fans are much better off. So when I saw this happen, and this is why I was a pretty early adopter of the Bitcoin thing, is I saw that evolving, and I kind of saw the same thing happening in music that was happening now with banks, right? Not just the bailouts, but, you know, the fees, the amount of service that you're receiving for really for what you're paying is not that good, And they're seeing that these bankers, and a comment you said to me, and this is, we can swear on here, I hope you don't mind, but you said that you thought everyone in finance were cunts, and I agree completely.
Sure.
They're taking advantage of a system that really is, that exists to be taken advantage of. And
well, that's what finance is. Finance is taking advantage of one thing or another, whether it's someone's gullibility in agreeing to usurious interest or someone's ignorance about the value of something that they're offering. It's basically impossible to have noble motives in finance.
Yeah, because greed is the primary factor. And as soon as that is your biggest, the biggest reason for your industry, then, you fail to innovate because greed matters more than innovation. And as soon as greed matters more than innovation, what you're really doing is you're setting yourself up for an ultimate failure because there will be an alternative method. And now we exist in a world where technology is making this possible. Great ideas are making this possible. And, how long did it take for, a somewhat decentralized model to really affect the music industry? It took, I'd say, probably 5 to 10 years, and it's still not completely finished, but, it's changed drastically already. Banking in finance, which is the first app of a blockchain technology, I want to mention that, it's going to take a long time, a very long time, before anyone really sees this happening. And it's most likely, it may not be Bitcoin, it may be something similar. I'm very open to that. But what jumped out at me was just that there is this system that exists that is inefficient, way too expensive, gouges people and has created so much equality and unfairness throughout centuries, because central banks have existed since the 1400s, 1500s, and that's, I don't want to make a specific year, but it's been a long time. This is ingrained in our lives. The first thing, from when we're born to when we people die, they're taught certain things about what money is, right? That's what you need to buy things, and here's how it works, and this is what you do. There's a technology that's trying to challenge this. So, of course, it's going to have resistance. Every good technology has resistance, and it pisses people off.
Okay, I appreciate the achievement of Bitcoin as a technological development.
Cool. Yeah.
Right? But I'm having trouble grasping how it's different or better than money.
Basically,
I understand that you can send it by email, which is kind of cool, but I also, I guess what most of the underground culture has been based on is not finding an alternative version of something in the mainstream culture, like in your example, finance, but making those things that we find repellent about the mainstream culture irrelevant.
Yes.
Right? So it's not, let's have our own lawyers and contracts and our own automated version of bill collecting. Let's not have lawyers and not have contracts and not have bill collecting. And not let's have our own version of exclusive relationships that we police, but let's not have exclusive relationships and not have any police.
Well, I think that the last thing is impossible.
And not let's have our own version of a repository of information, a centralized knowledge base, an ultimate authority, but let's not have an ultimate authority. Let's not have a centralized repository of knowledge. Let's not have an ultimate authority at all. And what you're describing with the utility of this Bitcoin technology is creating equivalents to items that exist in the material world, but in the digital ether. And my point, and probably the fulcrum of my existence, has been to eliminate those things from my life, not to create an alternative version of them that I could cherish as my own invention. Do you understand?
I do, but when you said things like eliminate those things from your life, I explain that a little more because I don't necessarily...
For example, yeah. I don't use contracts right. in business.
Right.
I literally do not use them.
Yes.
I've had a successful and extended career based on the idea that I'm only dealing with people that I can trust and who can trust me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So my records have been released on a record label. We've had a continuous relationship since the 1980s for the bands that I've been in. Never signed a piece of paper, never even had a verbal understanding of what our relationship, the details of our relationship. Basically, we share the profits of our records. When expenses are paid on the records, they're paid out of the general income from the record. When profits are turned, there's a profit figure. You take the income and the expenses and subtract one from the other, and the difference is profit. Take a knife, slice that in half, we get half, he gets half. It's a perfectly reasonable relationship that doesn't require any of the policing or any of the fine-tooth combing and the fine print and the arguing over semantics and the change of venue and all the other bullshit that's associated with a contract. We've saved all of that time, energy, hair-wringing, all of the money involved in having lawyers and court cases, you know, involving all of that sort of stuff. Just based on the notion that we trust each other and we're only dealing with people that we trust. I do exactly the same with the employees here at Electrical, with all the contractors that we use, with all the suppliers that we use. Electrical Audio is the name of the recording studio that I own and run. And in the terrified straight world, people would say, well, aren't you afraid of somebody taking advantage of you? Like someone books a bunch of studio time and then cancels it. Well, that happens very rarely. And it happens very rarely because we do a good job at vetting the people that we're working with. And we spend a little bit of energy making sure that the people that we're dealing with are trustworthy and building a personal relationship with them. And then we don't have to spend an extraordinary amount of time structuring agreements and contracts and collecting on payments that people are reluctant to make and that sort of stuff. So that's an example. I've made contracts irrelevant and unnecessary in my business. My band, for example, when my band goes on tour, we typically don't ask for a guarantee figure from a nightclub or a venue or a promoter that we're working with. We explain our operating principles and we deal with people that we can trust. And at the end of the night, there's a certain amount of profit left over. And then we divide that profit in an equitable fashion. It doesn't have to be prescribed. It doesn't have to be codified in a preordained number. We have a conversation about it, and we come to a reasonable agreement at the end of the night. I've been doing it that way for more than 20 years. I've been doing that way for 30-something years, and it's always worked. There's never, I've never been taken to court. I've never wanted to take anybody to court. I can count on one hand the number of times that not having indulged these structures has actually caused me any trouble. And the whole rest of my life has benefited from me not having to accommodate and indulge these structures. So the idea of having a handy digital version of, for example, a contract doesn't appeal to me because I think contracts are hideous. I think they define the terms over which you will have your next argument, and that's about it.
Yeah, and I also think that when you say that, make those comments, you're really looking at it from a very unique perspective of someone who, and first and foremost, I do really admire your business practices, and I think it's something that really is the way a business should be run versus how the perception is that businesses are ran. I do think that's true, and I think that I also agree with you with contracts because to me they're invalid because if I don't want to do something, I'm not going to do it. A piece of paper isn't going to make me do it, right? I agree with you, but I think
and
what
also
you're thinking,
contracts are generally unenforceable. Right.
Yes.
Let's say I have a contract with a big corporation. Like this big corporation agrees to give me a certain sum of money for if I do a job for them,
mm-hmm.
right? And then they don't pay me, and I decide that I want to sue them. Like the amount of time, money, and effort that it would take to bring suit against a company that probably has its legal staff prepared for such eventualities is completely outside the realm of reality. Like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to do it.
Yes.
So from my end, the contract is meaningless, unenforceable, has no value whatsoever. It provides me no cover. It gives me no protection. But from their end, if I failed to deliver on any tiny participle or whatever the word is of that contract, if I failed to deliver in their mind, they could quite easily bring suit against me and destroy me.
Yes.
Over that contract.
Yes, absolutely. And that, but to me, that's really, you know, that's a situation that is a result of decades of a system that has perpetuated that attitude. And that you...
It's not an attitude. It's a fundamental property of litigation as a tool. It's a fundamental property of contracts, is that the person who has money and power and influence and legal acumen can enforce his side of the contract. The other person, the less powerful, the less wealthy, the less sophisticated person, cannot enforce his side of the contract. The contract is not an agreement. The contract is a weapon. And it's only useful for the person who has the bigger muscles.
That's actually fascinating. I really do like that point, actually. And I don't even have a good response for it, so I will concede, because you're right on the general idea of contracts. And the one thing you did say about Bitcoin and how, you know, it basically, I want to paraphrase what you said, is you know, representative of currency, which still exists, you know, to support the people that are using it to take advantage of others, is the idea that that really happens a lot because of really greed, obviously, corrupting influences, those in power creating laws, regulations that really make it so companies can maintain this windfall of money that comes through and protect their wealth at the detriment of everyone else. And
sure.
there is, you know, that was the idea behind Bitcoin, right? And you know, there's a lot of political reasons behind it. And there's also the people that are involved with Bitcoin that make me the saddest are the investors, right? The people that make me the happiest are the original cypherpunk mentality guys that really created it as a system of saying, hey, this, you know, this monetary system here, I don't like it. I'm going to make my own thing. And, you know, it really took off because, you know, the governments of the world really, they didn't want to participate in black markets. They didn't want their currency to participate in black markets. So they created a competitive, really, you know, a place where people can, where a currency could be competitive, because there wasn't an ability to use that currency easily in these markets. So it became competitive, and then it started deriving value because people were using it to buy legal goods. And eventually, you know, it evolved into something that had more legitimate uses, but that was the original use, and that was the, you know, basically how it snuck in the door. And it ended up gaining value because the value is perceived, and that's how all money works. Value is perceived. And, you know, people perceived it to be worth something, so it was worth something. And what ended up happening was the Bitcoin network right now is ridiculously powerful. More powerful, I think, I don't know why to use the multiplier because I don't know it exactly, but multiple times more powerful than the world's strongest computer, or the world's fastest computer, rather. And it's only growing, right? New nodes are being added, and the protocol is still in beta, right? It's still, we're 6 years in, and it's still in beta. And that really shows you where, like, the infancy is of this, and really what possibilities exist. And, you know, it's distributed. That's the main point of this, though. And that is where the people get the power back, and where people really can control how this works. And, you know, I do think eventually something like a cryptocurrency will be corrupted. I don't think it's possible to avoid that, because those in power will corrupt. That's just the way the world works. And I don't know how it will be, but I do know for now it's an alternative that's worth working toward to make things better. Now I don't necessarily defend everyone in the community. I have massively different views from many in the community. I really try to take an apolitical viewpoint of everything, but, you know, obviously everyone has personal beliefs and feelings. But I think that across multiple industries and versus you, who created... Really, to me, you're a business person. You're an entrepreneur, and in the truest sense. Not in a bullshit, you're catering to the rules of how markets work because, you know, you wanted the Silicon Valley model, which is grow really fast and then, you know, and break things so you don't, you know, they can't stop you. That's the Silicon Valley model, and that eventually will be doomed. It's just inevitable. What is going to happen, though, is you're going to see people that kind of... Have businesses like yourself, right? Where you take a flat fee, right? Your idea of I think of good business practices is staying in business. Am I correct with that? Because that's how I view it.
Yeah, I mean, the cliche that's taught in business schools is that businesses exist to create profits for the investor class, and that's, you know, that's demonstrably untrue, because people create businesses because that's how they want to spend their time. Like, I run a recording studio because I want to run a recording studio. You know, I don't run a recording studio because it's, you know, the most sure profit engine. Of course it's not. There are other things, you know, or someone opens a restaurant, or someone runs a movie theater. Like, they're doing these things because that's how they want to, that's what they want to do with their lives. And in the process of doing that, if, you know, you have to turn a profit now and again in order to cover your expenses. Profit is sort of like drawing breath as an organism. You know, you need to breathe every now and again, otherwise you die. But you don't exist for the purpose of breathing. And you know, if I need to, I can hold my breath for a while, or if I have to go underwater for a while, I can hold my breath for kind of a long time. But and the same goes with being in business. If you know, if necessary, you can go without turning a profit for a while, but eventually you need to turn a profit as a business. But that's not the reason that you're doing what you're doing. The reason you're doing what you're doing is because you're compelled to do it for somehow. Like, that's the way you want to spend your life. So I think the idea that, you know, the profit side of it is the most important. I think that's a critical ill in our system. Like, that's a thing that has driven so much of the crazy stuff that's happened in business and finance and government, is people overvaluing this concept of shareholder profit, and, you know, as though that's the only money that counts, you know, as though the money that your employees get, that doesn't count. That's not real money. Only the investor money is real money, or the money that you spend in the community through your suppliers, or that you contribute to the common good through your taxes or assessments, or that you know, like all of this other money, like, as though that money doesn't count for anything, you know. And I just see money as a fluid resource, like air, you know. And it's not my money just because I happen to have it for the time being, any more than it's my air because I happen to be breathing it for the moment. It's money. It flows back and forth, or at least it ought to, you know. When it starts accumulating in one place, that's when it's a problem.
Mm-hmm. I very, very, very much agree with everything you said there. And I think that there's a mindset that the way that the world works, the way that, you know, and let me, I'm a little gone at which point I want to make now, but I think that, you know, something like Wall Street is serves no purpose. And when I mean that, this is probably going to piss off a lot of our listeners when I say things like this, and I understand, I don't really care, but they're not providing a good for the world. And what I mean by that is not in a hippie way, but in a way that in a true capitalistic society, and I say true, not what we're in now, it really, what would matter is the quality of work you do and the relationships that you maintain and your repeat business. A business would stay in business because people would be loyal to it, and they would really, you know, the profit wasn't as important as making sure that, you know, they came back next week. So, you know, you may forego the $5 sale, so they'll come back next week and buy something for a dollar because it's in your long-term best interest. And there's so many structures and so many regulations that are creating, not just regulations, but just so much greed and so many, the mindset and the technology. There's so many, it's a multifaceted issue, but that are creating what exists right now. And, you know, it's just this greed motive, and it really has, I think younger people, and younger than me, I'm 30, and I consider myself old for this Bitcoin thing, and that tells you how young a lot of the folks working on this are. I think that the mindset is so different with really young folks that are coming up. Their idea of intellectual property just exists on a different plane, and it's because of how, you know, what existed when they were getting, as they were growing up, and, you know, what they saw around them, and how they accessed media, information, news, whatever it is. And it really, I think it holds a lot of promise. And one of the things that I regretted, and we're going to let you go in a minute because it's been one of the best interviews I've ever conducted on here, is really just, you know, trying to spread the word about what the kind of software being developed in these open source communities by people that, you know, I'm very happy and proud to associate with. And it's something where the people that are working on this aren't doing it for greed. They're not doing this for money. They're really doing this because, for one, it really is for the betterment of everyone. It is kind of a hippie mentality, actually. And two, it really is to their own benefit, because these things that they're developing will eventually help them in their businesses, and they'll become tools that everyone can use. And that's really what the internet's based on right now, is a lot of open source protocols that have been tweaked and retooled and, you know, work much better. And it really is going to be interesting. And I can't wait for 5 years from now and 10 years from now to look back and say, okay, here's what Bitcoin did wrong, and here's why it never took off. Or here's why this replaced this. And here's why, you know, technology made this obsolete. Here's why, and I'm from Detroit, right? So here's why the big three, you know, failed to compete with Google and Tesla. Here's why this happened or that happened. It because you really can see, you know, what the technology does to any business. Really, it's something where, if you study this throughout history, as media and information methods improve, society improves. And greed has a little bit to do with it, in so much in the past that, you know, those who were really eager to make money utilized innovation to make money. But there also is a factor of the innovation being for the betterment of society. And I think that the way economies worked in those days were more simple. They weren't as bureaucratic. And this is from studying. I don't know, obviously. I didn't exist 200 years ago. But it seemed like you could open a general store and be able to make a living. That now can never happen, because big box stores that have an advantage because they exist in a corporate world would immediately put you out of business. And that's, you know, because they play by different rules.
I disagree with that.
Really?
Premise. That the notion that there is only ever one successful thing is one of the tenets of sort of market capitalism that I think is insane. You know, it's perfectly reasonable that you could have a small corner market, a bodega that serves a local, or a supermarket, a small market that serves a local population and adapts to their needs very fluidly and you know, can survive right alongside a massive supermarket that has everything in abundance, because it's more convenient. It serves the local market better. You know, I don't think that it's necessarily the case that there can be only one coffee shop. You know, I mean, the idea of this, the ravenous competitiveness of capitalism, is just so obviously flawed. It you know, in every neighborhood where there's like a mom and pop record store or coffee shop or magazine stand or anything, it demonstrates that, you know, that these small localized enterprises can subsist and survive. They don't necessarily grow, they don't necessarily compete, but they survive. You know?
And that though is the part that makes me the saddest, is that if that your goal is to survive, then
that's terrific. Survival is terrific. Survival is enormously underrated in the business community. My survival has ensured the employment of all of my employees. It's ensured the creation of several thousand records that will exist as historical documents that wouldn't exist otherwise. Survival is all it takes. You don't need to grow. You don't need to compete. Survival, if you decide how big your business needs to be, if you get there and you can stay there and maintain your existence, you have succeeded. There is absolutely no argument in favor of growth when you are the perfect size.
Right. Well, that is the issue, right, is how do you tell what the perfect size is, and do market conditions allow you to be the perfect size? You know, ask some small town that has a Walmart move in. It does change their economy, and it does create, you know, a completely different ecosystem, different jobs. People aren't usually as happy in their jobs. There's a lot more problems that come with this eventually.
Believe me, I'm not defending these sort of, like, oligarchic, capitalist, ravenous, big box chains. All I'm saying is that that, I mean, I never shop at those places. I haven't set foot in a fucking Walmart in my life. I'm not going to.
Good job.
Right? But you can compare that with, for example, Costco, which is a much more civilized company.
They
treats
are.
Its employees much better and treats its communities much better. Now, Costco can compete with Walmart. It doesn't mean that Walmart won't make more money every now and again, but it also doesn't mean that Costco is going out of business. You know, there's no reason that they can't both be there serving different parts of the market. I mean, perhaps it will eventually, you know, come down to people with a strong ethical position will only shop at certain places, and so those places will exist based on their ability to appeal to an ethical consumer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a possibility. That's a perfectly reasonable possibility. I don't think it's the case that because there is one thing that is successful, necessarily everything else fails.
I think that is a very valid point. And I do want to make one last point, and then I'm going to let you go.
Sure.
It's something you mentioned, and it really is interesting to me, and you mentioned in an interview I read, where you were talking about the cool kind of things that are happening on forums. And you I think it was directly related to music and how if you have some obscure interest, whatever it may be, and mine's this decentralized technology, and, you know, I'm really into that. And, you know, there are other things that I'm very into, and there's really good resources out there. And they're completely out of the realm of anything that you're going to find on what I actually think is a much more centralized internet that exists today than it did 15 years ago, where now you have these silos of Facebook, Twitter, Google, Apple. It's very different, I think, than it was then. But these places still exist on the internet where, you know, a really cool forum and a really cool message board, a really cool community exists where, you know, it's cool things come out of these. And I remember.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for people who are deeply interested and knowledgeable about something, communicating with each other in seriousness in a way that doesn't require any mediation. And I think that's what's great about the internet communities is that you have people who are all thinking about the same thing very intensely and all have directed a lot of their intelligence and their energy toward that one thing, and then they self-identify and they get together, and then, you know, before you know it, you have like all of the smartest people on a particular topic are all in regular conversation with each other.
It's beautiful. It's absolutely wonderful too. And it's so cool to see that. And what's weird is a lot of these are actually loosely associated. I've noticed that a lot of people that frequent certain topics, you'll see at other places. And, it's very strange and interesting. And I think the last thing I want to, I should say as a follow-up to this, what places on the internet interest you the most? Like little obscure corners, and maybe if you don't want to publicize them, I understand and I will respect that.
Oh, that's fine. I'm a fairly serious poker player, so I used to spend more time, but I do spend some time on the internet sites that are associated with the poker community.
So like 2+2?
Like 2+2 is probably the most famous one, and that's the best one, has the most resources, the most people on it. But there are others. And then there's an informal message board that our recording studio started where an awful lot of very smart people have gotten together and done some pretty incredible things. And that forum is it's tied to our webpage, electricalaudio.com, but the forum is unrelated to the business. There's essentially no, you know, we don't conduct any business on the forum. The forum is just its own free form, loosely associated with music, but generally associated with free thinking people, kind of forum. It's very loosely moderated, and topics roll on for years on there.
I have trolled it before. I shouldn't say troll. I should say lurked. And it was funny because I think it's going to be interesting if some of the folks on there read this, because the opinion of Bitcoin was very negative, but it was very finance centric. And I think that, you know, if anything that this podcast can do, I'm hoping, is get people to understand a little bit more of why there's different reasons people are into this, and the people that are in it for technology.
I understand. You know, you've said 8 or 10 times that it's not finance, but I have yet to hear an example of something that didn't involve a transaction or business.
Well, it does involve a transaction of information, and that's the key. That really is.
When you say information, I'm having a hard time seeing how there is any barrier to information at the moment.
There isn't.
I feel like I could find basically anything I wanted to know.
There isn't. There's just centralized entities that come between you and transferring the information, be they ISPs, be they protocols even, and which means Bitcoin is, you know, it technically is a protocol. So yeah, absolutely. And it really just does, it's about how you access it and how free it is. And it's a little bit of the net neutrality debate. It's a little bit about, you know, the censorship debate. There's a lot of little aspects in here that, you know, kind of come into play. And the bad example and the thing that I think is a shame is that the largest use of this technology right now is for finance, because I think it's alienating some smart people.
Give me an example of something that's not finance or something that's not a transaction. You keep saying it's information. I believe you. I believe that it's information. Can you give me an example of something that Bitcoin is useful for that is not a transaction or a contract or money?
Well, here's what I'll say. This is, it's not Bitcoin that I'm going to use the term. I'm going to use blockchain. And there's actually someone here in Atlanta that's created basically a network called Storj, STORJ, that's basically become a decentralized Dropbox. And the way it works is the same token system on Bitcoin, which means it does have the currency that needs to exist for the speculatory nature of it. But it really does, you know, it's part of a bigger puzzle that's going to create new methods of people being able to store things that aren't on centralized servers, but are actually more secure because they use things similar to, you know, PGP encryption and really ways to protect your information. And, you know, as long as you have the private keys, that is actually your data. It doesn't exist on a server with a back door that someone else can access. It's much more secure. And since it's open source, so many in the community have reviewed the code that really it is much safer than, you know, the services that we're using now. And now you're seeing a lot of concern about, you know, NSA. That's another feature that it has, is that, you know, it is more secure. PGP encryption is something that no one wanted, that the government did not want people to use. Well, too late. People figured it out a long time ago. And, you know, I think after the Snowden leaks, people kind of looked around and goes, okay, there's something to this. People are going to want privacy. We need to make this technology as, you know, as easy to use as possible. And money's been pouring in a lot lately about it, which is the funny thing about Bitcoin, is that so many of the people that started it are the people that hate the finance world. And that now they're hoarding their money, but to use it to destroy them.
Bear with me. The example is that you have an encrypted Dropbox, basically.
Essentially, yes, but it also exists on the blockchain, right? So, you know, you really are, you know, using it in a way that's completely different. And the ability that a cloud storage system can exist, it can't be censored or monitored, it can't have downtime, and, you know, it really becomes a suite of decentralized applications. And it allows anyone to really just store data in a secure manner, and it uses the blockchain almost as a transaction ledger, which, again, you're hearing this and you're thinking finance, finance, finance. And the terms are originated in finance. I can't deny that. What I can say is that the technology is going to have applications much broader than finance. And it really is something where it's a combination of things that I just mentioned, the encryption I mentioned, various cryptography that is way above my head. And much cheaper too. You know, it's much cheaper and faster in the end. Although, you know, we're going to need a faster broadband network in general, but it is than these other services. And, you know, Dropbox has had a lot of issues lately because people have Snowden being one of them. Glenn Greenwald, I think, mentioned something about how insecure, you know, whichever way you want to pronounce it properly. Is when your data is on these centralized servers in the cloud, and you know it's something where storage isn't known by everyone, of course.
So what you're describing is a way to secure something that is in cloud, distributed cloud storage, a way to make it private.
Yes, and that means you don't need to trust a corporation, you don't need to trust a server, and really you don't need to trust people. You need to trust the code and the people working on the code, but that's for the community to see and pore over and, you know, find bugs. And it really actually is much better. It's a much better method for real security than anything that you're going to get from a business or corporate entity, because, you know, there's so many eyes looking at it and really trying to fix problems that are involved with it. So it's more secure.
Okay, well, when that's going, I might be interested in it.
I'll send you a link. Storage is already actually live and active. I think what you're going to see is when this Ethereum project launches, and there's skeptical people too, and they have every right to be, believe me, because this thing, when I first heard it, I thought it sounded insane. But there's a lot of skepticism, but I think that the promise it has is absolutely huge, and it really could change the way the internet exists, and it has a lot of potential.
I still don't get what Ethereum is, but please don't try to explain it to me.
I won't. But what I will do is say thank you so much for coming on. This is one of the fascinating interviews we've ever had, and I actually wanted to leave with a song that I heard that you recommended somewhere on the internet, and it was Big Mo's City of Syrup. DJ Screw.
That's one of the most corrupted pieces of music I've ever heard.
And in a good way, though.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely fantastic, and I wanted to say thanks again for coming on the show.
Okay.
Like the jam music slow, still come up with subjects to make them hit the flow. 84s and Vos, look the freshest on my load, especially the four doors. Bumper straight against the road, floss mode console, looking like a lumberyard. Waving my trunk up and down the boulevard, charged the platinum card and the Visa to the max. Still won't get no sleep until my click see some packs, Cadillacs and six packs with gas bangers too. Click it, clack, clack, clack at your whack ass crew. Paying dues and staying true is the rules of the game. At the top of the food chain, bangers through it won't change.
In a dirty third, I'm gonna bang my screw. So what you want?